My name's Hugh Atchison, and this is Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot. On today's show, we visit a absolutely stunning labyrinth, a beautiful building in Chinatown that used to be an old Chinese opera house. Now it's a restaurant called Chinese Tuxedo. When it opened in 2016, the irascible Pete Wells, of the New York Times dining critic fame, called the place, quote, smart fusion. Thought the term fusion had gone, you know, the way of the dodo. But here it is, 2019, and we still are using a term that was really popularized in the 1990s for wasabi mashed potatoes. This restaurant, though, at its core, is really about global food. It's focused around Cantonese dishes, but then with influences of Australia and France, Sichuan food, Vietnamese food, Thai food. And the food's really, really good. And the space is, it's crazy. It's like the underworld den of Chinatown. It's like it was ripped right out of a movie. But today I sit down with Chinese Tuxedo's Australian co-owner Eddie Buckingham and Scottish chef Paul Donnelly. And they bonded over Asian cuisine in Australia way back when they worked together before. And they tell an incredible story about this global cuisine. So let's get down to it. If you're enjoying Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot, please give the show a 5-star rating. Because I'm worth it, I think. I don't know. We don't know. But go ahead, write a review. On Apple Podcasts, someplace like that. That'll help other people find the show. And if you're a first-time listener, please subscribe and download other episodes like Carla Hall Finds Soul Food and last week's episode, Andrew Friedman Eats at Gotham. Here's this week's conversation, Chinese Tuxedo Travels the World. Well, I am a Chinese Tuxedo. It's a restaurant in Chinatown in New York City in Manhattan. Chinatown really is Chinatown now, but it also hubs up to Little Italy, which is not really Little Italy anymore. But I'm sitting here with Eddie Buckingham, who's the co-owner and operating partner of Chinese Tuxedo, and with Paul Donnelly, who is the executive chef of Chinese Tuxedo. Glad you guys are here.
Thank you, mate. Welcome to Chinatown.
Welcome to Chinese Tuxedo, Chinatown.
It is an elaborate space, to say the least. I mean, it's, what, three levels? Two levels? Right now we're in the what's called Peachy's, which is the bar downstairs. Elaborate bar, busy, beautiful floral canopies of drapery and great wallpaper. But what is the layout of the building? What's the history?
Where we are right now, we're in the true basement of the building. It's kind of adjunct to Tuxedo. And as you mentioned, Peachy's, it's our cocktail bar, kind of the little sister to Tuxedo proper. But it is a very unusual building, an unusual space. The reason being it was the original Chinatown Opera House, the first Chinese language theatre here on the east coast of the USA. When we discovered it, so we opened the restaurant 2 years ago in November 2016, but we discovered it in late 2014, and it was a long road to kind of bring it to life, the space as we know it today. So when we first looked at it, it was a small mall, a bunch of different Chinatown business suites, but the owner of this property advised us that it had originally been that opera house. So we couldn't see any of the historic elements, but we were pretty confident they were hidden there behind drop ceilings and false walls and false floors and the like. So after securing the lease, we basically did a demo and tore the place to pieces to try and return it to that original scale.
That was the craziest thing you found, Eddie?
Probably the most exciting stuff, the most dramatic stuff,
were
just
the
original elements. So sitting right behind us, as mentioned, we're in the true basement now. You'll see the cinder block wall is kind of out of step with all the other materials. That being because there was a network of tunnels that ran under Chinatown from the late 19th century right through to about the 1980s. Some of the tunnels were open. And the notorious gangs of Chinatown, in this case the Hop Sing Tong, used it for kind of trafficking contraband, unbeknownst to the NYPD under the streets of Chinatown.
So the storied patina of Chinatown.
You can't fake that kind of drama and history.
That's
we're glad
great.
For it.
It's so funny that we're here in Chinatown in the States, and none of us are Chinese or American.
Probably got some running through our bloods, just a little bit,
yeah.
You know?
Chef Paul, you are from Glasgow.
Yes, born and raised in Scotland. Ate a lot of Chinese food when I was in Scotland.
It's really known as the epicenter of Hunan and Sichuan food.
Yes,
it
for
is Glasgow,
sure, you know.
Not really.
I think it's kind of not reached that level yet. I hear from some chef friends who are back there now that, you know, Asian cuisine starting to kind of take off a little bit, get a little bit more elevated. I haven't lived in Scotland since 2006, so I remember I was extremely young then. I was eating sweet and sour pork over French fries.
Yeah.
You know, that was kind of like
which is not on the menu at Tuxedo. I want to stress
that was kind of like the Chinese food
that's
in Scotland.
Chinese Scottish, you know? Poutine.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually a good idea.
Yeah,
we should put a Chinese.
No, don't. No,
no, no,
no. That's a bad idea. That's a really bad idea.
Which is horrific. No idea.
Eddie, you're from Melbourne.
Yes.
In Australia.
So my hometown is Melbourne, Australia, which had a very different kind of East Asian food culture and cuisine culture. So growing up in the 80s and 90s in Australia, it was a really important time for the development of Chinese cuisine in Australia, where it went from being, you know, a cheap and cheerful takeout option and really an acutely immigrant food to the forefront of Australian contemporary cuisine.
It really is so heavily inflected. Australian food as we know it now is so inflected with Asian flavors but more truthful Asian flavors. You know, we went through the fateful days of fusion food, where, you know, American interpretation of fusion food was like wasabi mashed potatoes and silly things like that, too. It seems like Australia always fully understood what they were getting into.
I think the proximity of, you know, having Asia so close to Australia definitely helps. Also, like, the climate and, you know, it definitely assists with produce quality.
Right.
Culture, people just kind of are starting to, like, really get into the culture of, you know, Asia, especially, like, the food. A lot of young chefs are coming up now, instead of being really interested in, like, I want to cook French food, I want to do this, I want to turn potatoes, they're really starting to, like, you know, take the notion to get into, like, Asian cuisine.
But when you guys were working together in Melbourne...
In Sydney.
Okay.
In 2008.
And what type of restaurant was that?
There was a Japanese restaurant, actually, a teppan restaurant, teppanyaki style.
Yep.
A little bit different from your kind of a typical teppanyaki restaurant. You know, there wasn't just one chef wearing this big tall hat, you know, being extremely elegant with his knife and his fork on the grill. It was a lot more casual, but the food was, I'd say, more elevated.
Yeah, it was exceptional quality.
And the chef there at the time who... you guys might know, his name is Sean Presland.
Okay.
Sean Presland was one of Nobu's kind of apprentices and really came through the ranks with him there. So Sean Presland was a chef who was based in Sydney, who was working for ANA, the airline company, doing all this amazing stuff. He got poached from Sydney to go to Nobu in the Bahamas. So he traveled over to Nobu in the Bahamas. He stayed there for 4 years. He took his whole team with him, poached this whole team from Sydney. They all went there together. And then 4 years later, the guy who he left then poached him to come back. So he kind of brought this new wave of Japanese food to Australia that hadn't really been seen yet. Doing all these kind of really cool different kinds of sushi, teppan style food. So I kind of got engulfed in that a little bit. And then that's when I kind of got into the Asian food. It kind of took from there. Then I started doing some Thai, and I started doing some Chinese and Vietnamese and Cambodian.
Chinese food and what you're doing here.
Yeah.
So it's such a big repertoire of possibility.
Yeah.
And learning it, like, go recount to me how you embark on something that's so vast. How do you pinpoint learning certain dishes? I mean, is it books? Is it cooking? Is it watching? Is it eating?
I think you can pair it with a lot of things. When I say compare, I mean you can pair it with a lot of things. I was really fortunate enough to work with, in my eyes, some of the best chefs in the world. I worked with one of my good friends, Jiawit Yu, who's the executive chef of Holy Fook in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with him for about 6 years. Another guy, Dan Hong, who's the executive chef of Miss G's and Mr. Wong in Sydney, who's kind of now really shot up the ladder in Australia. That with, you know, like, studying, research and development, travelling the world, I think that's a good insight on how to take a cuisine, like we were touched on it before we started recording, and kind of manipulate it a little bit into what you really foresee it, you want it to be, kind of like pushing the boundaries, pushing the envelope on produce and stuff. That was, you know, the key for me in terms of my education and development, learning Asian cuisine. Yeah.
And I'll speak further to that a little bit. With our offering here, we don't want to put too many limits on ourselves, too many restrictions. I think sometimes the American diner has a pretty narrow view of Chinese food and what it entails, or even more broadly, East Asian food. They have very set ideas about the kind of dishes, the kind of dressings, the kind of key proteins that you're utilising. But Chinese food is such a misnomer as a term. It's so broad. You're talking about thousands of years of heritage, a billion people, the geographic space, you know, the equivalent to a continent. It would be like... It would be absurd if somebody said, I'm opening a European restaurant in New York City, but that's kind of the equivalency. And so we had a couple of options. We could get very regional, very specific, super traditional, but that wouldn't be in step and true to our own story and development, you know, eating throughout Southeast Asia, throughout Australia, drawing from a broad range of regions, having a broad taste profile, different things that we like. And also, what are we solving for? You know, here in Chinatown, Manhattan, we're trying to offer people a broader perception of what Chinese can be. So if we put a lot of limitations of ourselves or tried to make it narrow, that wouldn't be in step with what we're looking for. We're also looking for, you know, a new kind of consumer, this, you know, the New York diner. There's been this explosion in the foodie movement, for want of a better term. We're trying to show them some of the things that Chinese cuisine can be, removed from, you know, their perception of Sunday night takeout, chicken chow mein kind of lines. So we wanted to give ourselves a broad scope and then pick the things we think we can do well. There are some things we don't mess with because we think you can get a better example in the neighbourhood, or maybe, you know, we can't do as exceptionally, but find the things we think we can do well and that we think that the New York diners will be excited by.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, right around the streets, this little undulating connection street, which is Doyers, in Namwa Tea Parlors right there.
Yeah, next door.
You're really in the thick of it.
Yeah, there's a few, even like the noodle places next door are excellent, you know, like people queue up there to get in just as much into those places as they do here, and Namwa's queued out every week, you know?
Yeah.
I think
Joe's Shanghai around the corner for Shanghainese soup dumplings. It's an icon.
And I think it's a good situation to be in. It's a good part, you know, part of a team of these restaurants. It's good to be in that because there's a different offering in each place, you know, and respectively you can get different things in each place, whether it be, you know, extremely elevated or people just wanting to go on a Sunday lunch and have yamcha.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
so
that's great.
That's, we're fortunate to kind of be in that bubble.
I love the use of the Chinese vegetables throughout the menu. And but one of the things when I ate here last year that was just sensationally good was stir-fried iceberg lettuce. And iceberg lettuce in the United States is known as like the ubiquitous pissed-on vegetable.
No,
it's just like given no respect. Yeah. It's like the McDonald's lettuce of all time. Yet to me, it is awesome in that one way, which is cooked, and rarely do Americans don't perceive lettuce as being a cooking green.
Yeah, it's true.
But in this case, it was so good and so vibrant, so almost crunchy still, and because of its the amazing amount of retention of water in it, it's almost like crisp on the outside and then tender on the inside. And then you've got it flavored with garlic and soy paste and really simple, but it was like so good. And one of the beautiful things about ice cream, it's dear cheap, which is great.
Yeah.
Really good.
We tried to
respect the margin on it.
We tried to put one at every table.
Yeah, there you go.
Lettuce, guys. It was iceberg lettuce.
No, but when we sell it with confidence because we do think it is a beautiful dish, and it takes a lot of guests by surprise. Some people, often people of, say, a Chinese background or who've worked in food, will recognize it for what it is, but it takes people by surprise. That's what
I think,
really proud of.
The simplicity of it as well. Sometimes if you're having a complex meal and you just want to have something nutritious and simple, and that's, you know, it's one of the reasons why it's on the menu, and it's fantastic, yeah. Nice and crisp, as you said.
In my cooking, I've got cruxes. I've got things that I always rely on. It's like really good olive oil and house-made vinegars and certain type of salts. What would you say reappears within the cooking that you're doing, Paul, every day? What are the things you're grabbing that really are foundational flavors throughout the menu?
I think for me personally, it would probably be the selection of vinegars and soys. I think they the layers of flavour and balance that they can really add to the dish, it's night and day, you know? So, for example, let's touch on the lettuce again. You know, I don't use a straight soy sauce in there, just because going back to, yes, the lettuce contains a lot of water, but me adding a liquidy into that again, it's just going to be a soup.
Yep.
So we opt to use a soy paste. It's a thicker starch soy sauce. Very soft on the palate in terms of its salt content. To touch on vinegar, the Changun black vinegar is my favourite. Adds another layer, a lot of acid. This might sound strange to say, but in terms of its flavour, I find it quite like beefy. Mm-hmm. It has like a beefy element to it.
It's got an umami like that, sort of beefiness. Yes. It's got a bouillon type of flavour.
It almost has a taste of a fake beef stock, mm-hmm. which it has. It's got none of that stuff in it.
But that's what it mimics in the end.
Yeah, it's like a golden plum vinegar. It's just absolutely gorgeous, very silky on the palate, enriching. And it really adds like different layers to food. When we have our red vinegars that we use in the dumplings, we have white vinegars we use in sauces and stocks. And then we have a fish stock based vinegar that we use to season our long life soup, which is a supreme broth that we are going to be having very soon. I think
that's funny. The American palate's changed so much that whether they know it or not, whether they understand those flavors and the histories behind them and the influences they've had on their native cuisines,
yeah.
where they're coming from in Sichuan or Hunan province or elsewhere in China and Shanghai, the American palate still seems now to be ready for that type of. They want bigger, bolder.
And there's even I've got friends working in 3 Michelin star restaurants in the city, and whenever he comes in here to have dinner, he'll be like, oh, fuck. He's like, we fucking use that at EMP or we use that at blah, blah, blah. Like mushroom powders and stuff like that. It just shows the diversity of, you know, where Chinese food has come from, its traditions. And you have people like Daniel Hum who are using those kind of products in their food. And for me, I think it's amazing. You know, it's inspiring to know that there's chefs out there who don't specialize in Chinese food. They're using it because they respect the job that it can do to a dish.
And I think that's the progress of food. You know, if I make traditional southern collard greens now or cream collard greens, it's now I fold in pulverized kimchi into the finish, and
yeah,
it completely changes things.
That sounds really good.
Bring any with you today?
not on the Delta flight. It just pushes the envelope. So, but those type of flavors have been indicative and within Chinese food for centuries and centuries.
Yeah.
But now they're really starting to morph into
they're
what we eat
to
on
spread,
an everyday
exactly.
basis. You know, when you look at chip flavors,
yeah.
you know, potato chip flavors on the shelf is just. What it was from 10 years ago
exactly.
is completely different now. Though in Canada, I grew up with ketchup chips.
Oh, we have them in Scotland.
Yeah.
Heinz
yeah.
ketchup chips.
Yeah. And
so good.
And they're so good, yet so disgusting.
really, nothing tastes better than nostalgia.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
It's definitely a deja vu moment. But that's where food to me is really interesting. Like great food for a lot of people pulls at the heartstrings. It kind of makes sense. It brings an evocative moment of a childhood or something like that that's good.
Yeah.
And it kind of comes full circle. So there's always narrative like that behind food that's intriguing. Let's get to the crux of business and how we do business in this weird world of restaurant and hospitality. I mean, you guys are in New York, the highest rents in pretty much North America. You've got a massive space, but it's tucked away in Chinatown. So is it more achievable here, do you find? Or is it, I mean, you're still doing an immense amount of covers, and I would assume that's necessary?
I think that Chinese tuxedo, we really had to strike at a moment in time. And maybe in another era it wouldn't have been possible in this neighborhood. It was very important to us that we did the concept here in Chinatown. So my business partner, Jeff Lamb, and I, some years ago, we were having a dim sum lunch just around the corner at a real favorite of ours, a place called Golden Unicorn, which is a big place set over 3 levels, old school kind of New York dim sum. And we felt that as fabulous as a spot like that was, as great as some of the restaurants that we've mentioned, icons like Nomoir and Joe's are, we felt that Chinatown didn't really have a venue that was in step with the contemporary New York food scene. So the decision to situate Chinese tuxedo here in Chinatown was less of an economic one and more of kind of a cultural one and what we wanted to speak to in the brand of the place. But this being 2014 when we started looking, there's no question that real estate was more affordable here than maybe it would be in some of the surrounding neighbourhoods. Chinatown's a remarkable neighbourhood in that, like, you have Tribeca to the east, Soho to the north, financial district directly south, you know, and then the Lower East Side to the immediate east. So it's surrounded with these prestige legacy neighbourhoods, all of which have really exploding food scenes in different identities between them. But Chinatown was kind of caught in aspic and a different kind of economy to some of those surrounding neighbourhoods. But the idea of the bargain in Chinatown, I think, is a bit of a misnomer. It still is downtown Manhattan. And so I think a space of this size maybe wouldn't have been possible for us in the surrounding neighbourhoods. But also, it would have been a very different restaurant. Even if it had opened at, say, six blocks west over in Tribeca, the identity of it, probably the demographic, the people coming through, there would have been a bit of variance. We're lucky. We get a lot of destination diners. We draw people from all over the city, the boroughs. We get a lot of international guests. We get, like, destination diners from uptown, from surrounding neighbourhoods. But the Chinatown was key to our identity here. We wanted to be kind of a contemporary Chinese food in step with what's happening in other great international food centres, East Asian food centres, I should say, like Shanghai, Hong Kong, Melbourne and Sydney, obviously, because that being our background. But we wanted to situate it right in the heart of New York's Chinatown, and that has been key to our identity, certainly.
How do you think the food culture here in the States overall differs from Australia?
The
restaurant culture.
To circle back to your comment before about how the US palate is evolving and maybe getting a bit more bold, a bit more experiential and experimental, drawing from more points around the world. I just think that's fabulous, and I think that's so appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many industries. New York remains, I think, the food capital of the world. People look to here to see what's happening and the like. Having said that, some of those business pressures you've articulated mean there's a bit of a homogenization. It's very risky here in New York, super competitive, super high outlay. So I think people are taking less risks to a degree. There's kind of a reversion to the mean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are hitting what they know, the tried and true formulas. I'm not being critical of that. It's a big process to open a restaurant. You want to mitigate your risk. But it means that we're in the age of the New York, you know, Italian trattorias and French bistros. They're gorgeous, they're world class, but right now my concern is there the breadth happening in New York City?
Right.
But the thing I like about New York and think is so special about it is you can be ambitious, you can take a risk, and I think you don't have to take over the city here. You don't have to take over the food scene. You just need to find your lane. And we've been pretty deliberate in understanding what our lane is.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be one thing to open this up and have food that was pulled out of a P.F. Chang's, and another thing for you guys to be doing truly, honestly amazing food in a venue such as this. I mean, it fits and it works. But it also works in this neighborhood, I think, really well, because it just, the way you guys have designed it and sort of the almost opaqueness of how you, the entry and stuff like that, and then marked by a couple of neon things, really, I don't know, it just drives
like
it.
Sets the tone,
really,
you know?
Interesting. It sets the tone really well.
I think that when you walk through the front doors of Chinese Tuxedo, taking into consideration the street that we're on, you know, you come from either angle, whether you're coming from Pell Street all the way around and those neons hit you, you kind of have like that expectation of, I feel like, what's about to happen. Like, and when you come through the doors and the music's on and the candles are lit and the flowers are up there and the room's bustling, I feel like people have really taken on board, like, the expectation. And touching on what Eddie said is, well, people, you know, were willing to give it a chance considering where we were situated, you know?
Yeah.
With the expectation of, oh my God, this place is going to be really expensive, but we've got many other cheaper options around.
No, I mean, everything on the menu is really fairly priced. Yeah. And it's really meant to be a sharing menu. So with sharing menus, it's really up to the consumer to figure out what they want to spend. You can definitely get fed for not that much money at all. So
we do inhabit a different category to the rest of the neighborhood, or a number of the other venues in the neighborhood. But that's appropriate.
It is appropriate.
Yeah.
So that's cool. So, Paul, when you're running a kitchen these days, how has it changed over the last 10 years? What do we need to do as chefs these days, or what do you think we need to do as chefs these days to retain people? And
so that's an excellent question, and to be honest, I get asked this question quite a lot, and I kind of take a bit of pride in answering it, because I look back 10 years ago when I was a young chef, and even as little as 5 years ago, looking back around when I wasn't as senior, but, you know, really catching a vision of the way other chefs were reacting around other chefs and even to front of house staff. I think the way the direction of, you know, culture in the kitchen is really evolving now is that you kind of have to have a lot more compassion.
You can't be an asshole anymore.
You can't be a fucking dick anymore, because
you shouldn't be an asshole in any
industry.
No, you shouldn't be. But you know, just a weird hangover in kitchens.
Being in our industry, especially as a chef, it's almost like there's the expectation of that you're going to get fucking bollocked every day, which is not the case, you know? I think for me, you know, in terms of the way I operate, in terms of getting the best out of my team, is that if there's an issue, you know, like, don't start all this shouting and bawling. You lose, they're done. You'll just lose them for the rest of the day. You know, you need them just as much as they need the job. And we kind of sit down at the end of the night if there's been an issue. I'm not saying we hold hands and give each other a kiss, but we really kind of like nut it out. You know, what was the issue? You know, and I think that you know, there's a lot of chefs these days who are now starting to operate that way, because they have. They understand that they can't be dicks anymore.
Yeah, I think the most productive kitchens and the ones that are really pushing the envelope and doing a continuously good job of consistency but also progressing are happy kitchens.
Yeah,
they're well led with enthusiasm and a concentration by good leadership who understand how to harness energy and harness a lot of different personalities. But also to give them credence. I don't hire anymore just filling in gaps. I hire people hopefully who are better and smarter than me.
Yeah.
And it helps me a lot because I can teach them something about leadership.
For sure.
They can teach me a lot about drive and how we change things.
And I just think that's good human capital practice.
It is.
And if you spoke to leaders in any industry or field, that would be the objective. But for some reason, kitchens, they've had this macho culture for so many years.
There's a stigma.
And look, there's no question, ours is an industry for misfits to a point, both front of house and back of house. I don't mean that as a criticism. I self-identify as a misfit, and I'm proud of it.
Yes,
proud of it.
I'm a responsible misfit.
That's right. So at the end of the day, Paul and I spend a huge amount of hours in this building, and you kind of have a choice of how you want your own personal work life to be and your work life for your team. And if it's a nurturing environment where people can develop and grow, they can see opportunities, mistakes will be made. Mistakes are made in any workplace, but we take them as teaching moments and developmental moments and create that kind of healthy, nourishing workplace for the team. It makes our life so much nicer.
We have such a big responsibility to be able to help young chefs and waiters and waitresses and bartenders and mixologists to get them where they need to be for their career, you know? I was given that guidance. Yes, I mean, I got a couple of slaps around the back of the head when I was doing it, being a young chef, but, you know, I got there in the end.
Chef Paul, why don't you introduce? We've got a little bit of a snack right in front of us right now. Yes. We're going to eat some food.
It looks delicious, doesn't it?
As they set up the restaurant upstairs, which you'll hear tables being dragged.
Just for context, it's a cold, cold day in New York City today.
Yes, so this is one of the this is one of the kind of a newer snacks or dim sum, if you will, that we've put onto the menu in the last couple of weeks. So obviously, you know, to describe it, we have this cute little kind of a Chinese inspired cup and saucer, like a teacup. Inside there is a scallop and shrimp wonton, and it's just been topped up with some supreme broth, also known as long life broth, traditionally made with whole chickens, smoked ham, dried scallops, also known as kompoi, and shrimps. We just season that up with some white pepper, a little bit of my riff is that I put some dashi in there, which adds even more smokiness, a little bit of light soy, some ginger oil.
It
has this real kind of a saltiness, sweetness, you know, a lot of umami.
And I like the ginger oil on the back of the,
the broth. And then we make a raft and consomme the broth just to kind of give it a little bit more clarity. It's usually generally pretty cloudy traditionally. But it's just kind of our element on it, you know?
Every culture has a sort of soothing matzo ball soup, and this is it. This is, it's just amazingly complex, the broth and the mousseline and the dumplings, great. So just beautiful and fresh. But it's funny, back to being, geez, we're all foreigners. I'm Canadian, you're Aussie. You're Scottish. It sounds like the beginning of a bad joke, but
in a Chinese restaurant.
walk into a Chinese restaurant and order matzo ball soup. But it is. It's. We're finally at a time where I think that the conversation about appropriation is appropriate, oddly enough, to have. But you know, there's also a degree where cultural appropriation and back in the days of fusion seemed really inappropriate. And it wasn't appropriate because I think that people failed to understand the depths of the food that they were playing with. That they were giving a couple of attributes of Japanese food to really westernized food.
Yeah.
Without digging deep first and realizing the amazing bounty and history that was there. You know, American food is a really nascent cultural thing. I mean, it's only 200 years old as we what we know as food, and it really relies mostly on Southern cultural food in the South, which is really impacted from West Africa and the Golden Geech communities. But it's really interesting to come into a place doing Chinese food made by white people that has actually cultural significance still to it. It's not glossing it over. And that's why I think it is appropriate now. When you talk about Andy Ricker with Pok Pok, you're talking about somebody who lives half of his time in Thailand, fully understands the culture and the cuisine, has an encyclopedic knowledge of it. So I think that's where appropriation gets pushed to the side and is no longer.
It's true. It's very true.
But this food shows a respect for the food.
Exactly.
It's first and foremost.
And that was something that, you know, from day one that we discussed it, you know, many, many, many times was we want to keep the flavors and history intact, but why not push the envelope and do it? Like, for example, like this is a perfect example. Your typical Chinese restaurant maybe wouldn't present this like this, you know, but however, when you eat it, it tastes historical, you know. And there's
it's a very classic, traditional, elegant dish, but we've tried to present it in a more New York fashion.
Yeah, exactly.
Just trying to be sympathetic
and touching on, you know, we're talking about Andy Ricker as well, you know, David Thompson. Mm-hmm. Of Nam in Bangkok is a fantastic other example who really studied regal Thai cuisine, spent time cooking for the King of Thailand, and really elevated Thai food. You know, he's got this fantastic, I call it the Bible, it's my favorite cookbook, mm-hmm. called Thai Food. And he's another perfect example of a chef who really, restaurateur who really pushed the boundary on Thai food and really added his own thing to it, you know.
He's his own walking encyclopedia, that man.
Yes, he is.
It is really.
For us in the development of the concept and development of the menu, that was something that was always at the forefront of the mind. It couldn't be a secondary consideration. It had to be a primary consideration. Is this respectful? Is this thoughtful? We still wanted to put our own signature on everything from the guest experience through to the food. But growing up Australian, or for Paul, spending so much time cooking in Australia, this food is part of our collective experience, both from the everyday food that you access, the food you might cook at home. As a kid, you know, I cooked more with a wok than a flat pan, just cooking for my family and the like, through to the very kind of high-end dining experiences. So growing up as a kid in Melbourne in the 90s, when we had special occasion dinners, be it, you know, a birthday or a graduation or whatnot, the restaurant that we wanted to go to, the restaurant that was the most special treat for me growing up, the most, like, important restaurant for me, was a Cantonese restaurant. So it's also part of the Australian collective experience. I don't think that would have happened so much here in the States. I think when people think of their high-end restaurants, they're typically, you know, that you see the European influence, be it French or Italian. You know, there's this wave of neo-Spanish happening right now. Contemporary American is such an established prestige category. But for us, spending a lot of time in Southeast Asia, growing up in Australia and really learning food in Australia, this food is stuff that can be celebrated, can be ambitious, can be kind of dynamic, whereas, and we wanted to to show that and champion that. That's what it's born of.
I was shooting a TV program outside of Toronto, and Toronto's got a massive, massive immigrant community. And the Shanghai community is very big there, and there's a lot of Hong Kong influence. And more in the on the eastern side of the city, there's a huge enclave of quite high-end Chinese eateries, and one of which was really known for whole crab. And the place is massive. It probably seats 400 people.
Wow.
Tanks all along all the walls. And they pick your crab, they bring it to you live, and then they take it back and cook it and serve it in eight different presentations.
Fabulous.
Your bill comes.
You're going to get to Toronto. Yeah.
There were three of us. There were three of us eating. And our bill was $700.
Wow.
I mean,
gold plated,
really expensive. I mean, it was really expensive. And then huge, like somebody next to us got like a 12-pound lobster. I mean, the thing was, half the size of me. And then the kicker was, and this is such a sort of Hong Kong restaurant thing, is you can only pay in cash. And I was like, it's 700. Who has that much cash? Somebody's going to rob this place. I mean, the place
is
packed.
This is Chinatown, man. It is. Everybody has that much cash.
But I was just blown away. But the place was just utterly packed.
Was the food good?
Food was great. It was great.
$700.
It was best $700 crab I think I've ever had. Yeah, I had to go to like three different bank machines. I'll dotter around the neighborhood right nearby quickly to rummage together the cash.
See, interestingly, you won't find a lot of that here in New York. There's some pretty compelling places out in Flushing.
In Flushing, you will.
We did all of our when Paulie first came to the States to do some tests, some kitchen testing and the like. We did all that out in Flushing. With some Shanghainese friends out there, but there are a couple of big old school places in Flushing, but that Imperial Cantonese that you speak to, which we both love,
that's my favorite way to eat.
We find it that certainly in Manhattan, there's not a lot that fit that category.
It's kind of it was crazy over the top this week. I mean, it was really interesting to see. A woman was having her she looked like the grandmother or the matriarch of a family. There was eight of them sitting at a table, and she got her birthday cake, and there's a smaller beautiful cake, and there was the end of a dollar bill, what looked like a dollar bill sticking out of it, wrapped in a little plastic clear envelope, but it was $100. And she started pulling it. It's in the cake, wound up. She started pulling it, and it was like $300 bills all in a row in this special little clear envelope. I mean, it was that type of crazy over the top.
Well,
restaurant.
She probably needed it for the check. But
well, yeah,
she should have brought a cake.
I was like, hey, can I write you a check? You can give me cash. That would be great. So, Chef, what are you most excited about? Like, how, in the food, where do you want to see it go? What do you figure you're what's the learning curve? To me, the funnest part of our business is we never get to say it's done. We're constantly learning.
You're right. There's an education that we don't have yet.
Yeah.
That is only around the corner.
But that's what food is. Food's an endless topic, and it's the deep dive. So what's the deep dive that you want to go into and explore?
I think for me, social media is, over the last 5 years, particularly Instagram, has really, really blown up. I'd say for me, in terms of like the chefs who I follow on Instagram to see, what the trends are in Italy, what the trends are, in Chicago, back home in Australia, the UK. I take a lot of looks at René Redzepi's of Noma. Some of the produce, the weird produce that he utilizes and what he does with it is absolutely incredible. Now, we're talking different cuisines. There's a lot of produce here that, that I haven't experimented with. It's only a matter of time before I get my hands on some. Some of the stuff's expensive and we don't know, can we utilize these products well enough to justify selling them? So like sea cucumbers, which can go for thousands of dollars each,
Which are mostly fished for on Fogo Island, Newfoundland.
That's right.
Which is an amazing, beautiful island off the coast of Newfoundland. And they really tapped into that market because they're really known for cod fisheries there and snow crab.
And a couple of Chinese business people in the seafood industry came over about 10 years ago and figured out that they had sea cucumbers everywhere. And so it became this huge part of their economy, which, you know, nobody really eats sea cucumbers.
There's a lot of money in that market as well, you know. You know, even things like pearl meat, you know, Eddie was touching before on one of his favorite Cantonese restaurants in Melbourne. They've got this fantastic dish on the menu where they do stir-fried pearl meat.
Mm-hmm.
Serve it in this really luxurious scallop pearl shell, essentially. And it's just like stuff like that that really get my mind going. You know, it's like produce like this, you don't see it here.
Yeah.
It's like, how can we get a hold of things like that to really take our education to the next level?
Well, that's the thing. If there's demand for it and you want to buy it, you can get anything in New York. So it's a good time to be here.
And the good thing is now, I feel after a couple of years, we've engendered, pardon me, a little bit of trust in our consumer. So maybe if we'd opened doors with some of the more esoteric lines like that, they might have been a harder sell. But we've done all sorts of interesting things, from jellyfish through frogs.
I frequently get live frogs in. I'll pick them up from Chinatown in the morning, and when I'm walking to work, I'm holding this little red bag, and I can feel them. I can feel them jumping everywhere. So it's like, as soon as I get in, I pretty much have to butcher them straight away. But stuff like that, and customers love it. You know, and we do it different ways. We'll stir fry it with asparagus and white chives, or we'll do it salt and pepper style with chili relish. So things like that really. Also, it's inspiring for the team to see different things that we've never seen it before, you know?
But you've got to constantly inspire them. Yeah. I mean, these days for a cook, to keep cooks for a long time, you've got to teach them and inspire them, and they have to be excited to come to work every day.
They need to be evolving as well, you know?
If it's a job of drudgery in this employment market, they're never going to show up tomorrow.
Exactly. We've been fortunate enough to retain a lot of our staff for the duration that we've been open. You know, yes, we've lost some staff as well, but that's fine. You know, it possibly wasn't the place for them.
That's going to happen.
You know, like,
it's inevitable.
Some of the guys who, you know, brought out our delicious snacks, they've been with me for 2 years, you know, and that's really refreshing for us to know that we are inspiring these young guys and girls to hang around and get a better education and hopefully give themselves a better career.
I opened up my first restaurant in 2000. We still have some of the waiters and some of the cooks are still there from day one, which is crazy. I mean, but it means that they have a sense of ownership of the place.
It's a positive reflection on yourself as well. You know, it's like you're giving as much as you can, and they're appreciating and respecting you to the point where they don't want to work anywhere else.
Yeah, yeah. So. Like, the gravestone that I want has always been, man, he's a pretty nice guy and good employer. That's good enough for me. So,
very Canadian of you. Very.
Yes, we're very, uber apologetic.
As an Australian, I sympathize.
Yes, Well, you guys have been amazing to have on the show and to talk about this amazing entity you have called Chinese Tuxedo. So it's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Eddie?
Thank you for coming down to Chinatown.
It's good to be here. We love it.
We'll rustle you up some lettuce before you go.
There you go.
With frogs.
Yes, and frogs. That's cool. Do you guys get abalone much? Does abalone and stuff like that?
I dabbled in abalone when we first opened.
Mm-hmm.
And I was getting it from New Zealand.
Okay.
And it didn't travel very well, so I stopped specialing it. I think the shock.
Yeah,
the abalone.
There's a Hawaiian producer, Maui, Kona abalone company. They're really good.
Actually, I've heard of that. Maybe I'll get into
try
that. I love abalone.
Yeah, me too.
It's fucking
and
so
the Santa Barbara guys are pretty good.
Yeah. Actually, so, and so I also
as a proud Victorian, Melbourne, Australia, I'm only interested in Victorian abalone.
Yeah,
I'm not pretentious on much, but abalone is
Tasmanian sea urchins. Incredible.
Yeah, it's really good. Sea urchin comes all the way in down the St. Lawrence almost, where it's brackish waters, so way inland into Quebec, and all the Joe Beef guys get all their uni from there.
Yeah.
And it's so good.
Canada's got some fantastic seafood.
Yeah, it really does. Weirdest places, too, because, I mean, if you look at a map of North America, that's almost like above Quebec City.
Yeah.
And they're getting it, so it's pretty crazy. But.
Out of brackish water.
Yeah. Kind of crazy. Different world. Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank
awesome.
You. Real thank pleasure. Thank you very much. Pleasure to meet you guys.
Thank you for your time.
This episode of Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot was taped on location by Brian Blum, a Chinese tuxedo in New York's Chinatown.
Scott Borch produces the show. Mackenzie Mizell edited this episode. You can follow Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like what you hear, please rate and review and come back on Tuesdays for a new episode. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Hugh Atchison. Be forewarned, I'm kind of a dweeb, but a good dweeb. Okay, thanks for listening. Eat well. Be well.